All right, thanks for tuning in. You are listening to Gaucho Amigos. I'm Alex. My guest today is Elliot Randall. You know, there are a lot of amazing guitar solos in the Steely Dan catalog, but none are as well known or as recognizable as the one that Elliot played on Reelin' in the Years. Somewhere in the world right now, you can hear it, whether it's playing at a bar or an airport or a shopping mall. And it's obviously in large part thanks to Elliot's solo that that song became such a classic rock staple. I mean, Elliot's just a phenomenal guitarist in general. He's collaborated with everyone you can think of. He also played solos on a bunch of other Steely Dan songs as well, on Katie Lied and The Royal Scam. And he also knew Donald and Walter pre-Steely Dan. You know, they played shows and even recorded together back in New York in the late 60s. Anyway, we got into all of that in our conversation, and it was a real honor to get the chance to meet and talk to Elliot. He was dialing in from London, where he now resides. So without further ado, this is my conversation with guitarist Elliot Randall. Enjoy.
Well, I was good friends with Marty Coopersmith, who was one of the Americans, and also Kenny Vance, who wound up producing their earliest demos. At one point, I was just invited to, you know, come and play with Jay and the Americans, and I said, yeah, great. And we all hit it off really well. I recognized that Donald and Walter were pretty unique from the get-go.
Yeah, what was your kind of first impression of them?
Weird, wonderful musicians with great senses of humor. Really, really just... They were good mates. They were really cool.
And this was when they were like kids practically, right? They would have been in like their early 20s at this point.
Yes. Yeah. We all were. At some point toward the middle of my tenure working with Jay and the Americans, Kenny Vance started producing some demos of Donald and Walter. And they asked me if I would come and play on them. And, already being a fan, I said, sure. You know, we went into Mayfair Recording Studios in New York City on 47th Street and made a bunch of demos. You know, spent evenings in the studio just being as creative as possible within the realms of what Donald and Walter were looking for. And I'll tell you where that went. It went absolutely nowhere until a certain point. I remember Kenny trying to shop the tapes around, and virtually every record company and every publishing company didn't get it. It was one of those thanks, but no thanks.
The songs were too weird, right?
For them, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
But not for you. You were into it.
No, I loved it. I've always been into strange, you know, interesting, challenging music. So as things turned out, Gary Katz, who was also working at Mayfair at the time, and was a friend of all of ours, took the tapes out to L.A. and played them to Jay Lasker, who was at that point the president of ABC Dunhill Records. And Jay got it. He really liked it. He wanted to sign them as writers. And that's what they did. And after a lot of nudging and pushing, the guys finally got a chance to hit the studio and make some, you know, recordings. And then here we are.
Yeah. So when you were playing on those demos, just to backtrack a bit, because I do want to hear a little bit more about that experience. Mm-hmm. What was their kind of recording process like? Do you remember, like in those very early days?
Yeah, they were pretty well focused even then. They knew what they were looking for. My memory isn't such that I could remember the songs or what they were called. What I remember is the process, and the process was really enjoyable. It was, these guys already knew what they wanted, and it was a question of figuring out the puzzle and contributing something that would be personal as well.
Yeah, so I don't know which songs you're on, because I've actually gone back and listened to a lot of those demos. But on the later Kenny Vance release of some of those early years demos, he credits you on Brooklyn.
Yes.
So you played on that. That was the and the original Brooklyn, pre Can't Buy a Thrill, the one where Donald sings it, not David Palmer.
That's right.
Yeah. But you probably played on a few others too, but just we don't know which.
I did. I have a few samples someplace tucked away, but I don't think that they indicate the names of what the tunes were.
Oh, you
And they
have,
weren't really,
yeah.
no, and they weren't really wonderfully recorded. I mean, they were just demos.
Yeah.
So
Yeah, in terms of
whenever
the
you
fidelity of things, Can't Buy a Thrill is like a massive leap forward compared to those early ones. So,
Oh God, yes, absolutely.
any more memories in terms of your experiences of playing with the Jay and the Americans? Like, did you play shows with them?
Oh yeah. I mean, that was basically what we were doing. We'd go out and play the different doo-wop-y kind of shows, mostly in the area, New York, New Jersey, Long Island. And they were great fun. They were really, really cool to do.
And this is at the same time Donald and Walter were also, part of the backing band.
That's right.
So did you form like a friendship with them?
Yes.
Yeah.
I wouldn't say it was a really close friendship at that point.
Okay.
But we were peers. We admired what each other did, and we're always happy to see each other and play music together.
And you said they were unique and talented. I mean, did you have a sense that they were actually going to like, blow up and become rock stars, before this all started?
At that point in my career, as it is today, I would never bet on a horse. They were great, but there's a lot of greats that get completely overlooked, and there's a lot of stuff that should be overlooked. So, it was anybody's guess. I know that when I walked out of the studio, having done the Can't Buy a Thrill tracks, I was really, really satisfied and really, really impressed with the product that we got. So if somebody asked me, will they make it? I might say, well, there's a good chance they will.
Like, what else were you doing, musically at this time? Were you playing with other people as well?
Well, in those days, I had just come off of a couple of tours, first with Eric Mercury and then with my own band called Randall's Island. And at the end of that tenure, we wound up going to Broadway doing Jesus Christ Superstar. So that actually sort of weaves itself into the story of Can't Buy a Thrill. But I was also starting to get a fair amount of session work. And the more I did, the more I got hired. I was a very lucky guy.
And it seems that you kind of preferred to do that than actually have sort of an ongoing single band or project, right?
A lot of people assume that, and it's almost right. That is to say, I very much love doing studio work and always have. But I've also always loved performing. And so the question is, the longevity of my relationships with the bands that I went and played live with was usually never more than a year. Because, one sort of wants to move on, I think. At least that was the case with me. It was like, yeah, I've played this already, good. It's cool, but now it's time to try and find something new.
So it was more of a like creative impetus that kept you kind of moving from project to project.
Oh yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Another question, because this ties into Can't Buy a Thrill. So obviously Skunk Baxter ended up joining the band, and he was a founding member of Steely Dan. Is it true that you knew him
Jeff,
like well
yeah, we did.
before?
We yes. We both worked on 48th Street, which was, the street that housed all of the music stores. Some called it Tin Pan Alley, although that wasn't quite correct. Jeff worked at a place called Manny's Music, and I worked at a place called Ben's Music. And usually we'd find time on our lunch hours to get together in one of those two places and jam. So we really had a fair amount in common. We had the same idols.
Who
Howard
were they?
Roberts, the jazz guitarist,
Okay.
was top of the list. And we also listened to all of the twangy stuff that was going on those days, obviously, Duane Eddy, the Ventures. Yeah, it was mostly guitar-oriented music that we were fooling around with.
Cool. What was he like in those early days, just as a, buddy?
In those days, he was fun. You can read into that what you will.
Okay. Are you still in touch with him? Just out of
No,
curiosity. No.
not at
Okay.
all.
Not at all. Okay. So Donald and Walter go out to LA. They hook up with Gary Katz, and they form this band. What was your reaction to that?
Oh, I thought it was a great idea. What brought me out to LA and into the same sort of small radius was in 72, after playing in the Broadway pit of Superstar for a year. I was starting to go nuts, and
How come?
I just, well, because it was, even though it was steady money, which musicians always love to see, there wasn't very much creativity to it. So I used to liken it to, being a secretary going into an office and having to type the same letters every day, 8 shows a week. So a year was enough for me. I went out to LA, and within a short amount of time, I got a call from Donald and Walter asking me if I would come and help them record Can't Buy a Thrill. And my response was, absolutely. When should we do this? And they, gave me the address of Village Recorders and the date, and I came out and we started hitting it.
Did you start with Reelin' in the Years? Was that the first
Yes,
track you played on? Oh,
that's
it
right.
was.
That's
Yeah.
right. Yeah.
Tell me about that experience, because
Oh, it's.
obviously your solo on that is like the stuff of, not just Steely Dan legend, but classic rock legend.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
Well, let me see. I went in, said, "Where's the amp?" And everybody looked like, "Well, we don't have an amp here." In New York, all the studios had amplifiers. In LA, hardly any of them did. So we needed to find an amplifier for me to play through. And as fate would have it, a guy who is now my friend, called Dennis Weinreich, who was an engineer and a studio owner himself, was rehearsing his band right next door to the Village Recorder. And he said, "Well, we have an amp next door. If you'd like, I can have the guys go get it." I said, "Yeah, please." So they did, and it was an Ampeg SVT. It was the biggest amp you've ever seen. It had 8 10-inch speakers, and I don't know how many hundreds of watts to it. It was really, really awfully loud. And I remember Roger Nichols and I looking at each other, going, "Oh, we're gonna make this work?" And, "Yeah, we'll make this work." And we did. We did. I played it full blast, all the way up to volume 10. And I remember Roger going out into the room and wearing a headset, but it wasn't an audio headset. It was one of those Jet Propulsion Laboratory headsets. So he gets some sort of an idea of where what was coming from where without really hurting his ears. And he wound up placing an AKG 414 microphone into what he thought was the sweet spot, came back in, and I played, and we all really enjoyed what it sounded like. So that was the amp sorted out. And so they ran the tape. I really liked it. Couldn't quite get all the lyrics. And I said, "Donald, can I get a copy of the lyrics?" And Donnie and Walter just looked at each other and smiled and handed me the lyrics because I wanted to know what emotions, what scene I was playing to. It wasn't just to, react to the physical, notes themselves. So we ran it, and I thought it was going to be a take. And we did what I'm told, retrospectively, was probably a better solo than the one that you hear on the record. And what happened was Gary Katz turned to the assistant engineer, the tape operator, and said, "Right, let's hear that back." And the guy just turned absolutely ghostly white and said, "Oh, I never hit the record button." So, what
Oh
do you
my
do? You shrug
gosh.
your shoulders and you say, "Okay, let's do it again." And what you hear is literally what I played from top to bottom. There's no inserts, no punch-ins. It was my response to the tune.
Wow. So it was actually the second take, but it was the first recorded take that ended up on the song.
Exactly. And of course, they faded it to be, I don't know, 4 minutes and however many teen seconds it is. But what they did was there's a quadraphonic mix of it that some people have heard. And that goes a little bit longer. I can't say that, wow, man, they should have kept it. Because to me, the production of that piece of music really worked. It really worked very, very well. And even today, if I'm testing out monitors or something, I'll listen to that for reference as well as other things because I know it so well. And it's just like, yeah, it's cool.
So what was your reaction when the song blew up and became a big hit? How'd you feel
Oh,
about that?
I was delighted. Absolutely. It was the first really big record that I had been involved with. That I could say, yeah, I did that solo. I mean, I did a lot of other things for other artists, but was more in the background. So this was an absolute godsend. It also did amazing things for my career because once that record became popular, the phone didn't stop ringing. And funnily enough, a lot of people wanted me to be that same guy, to do that same sound and. Every sound is unique to the sounds that it's surrounded by.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's common when someone, has a major success with something specific. People wanna, they want that sound, or they want to recreate, what you did on that particular thing that was popular, or, made someone a lot of money. So yeah, I can understand that. But I guess
Absolutely.
kind of like you were saying, you're sort of a creative spirit. So, you had to kind of, I would imagine you kind of had to do things your own way.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah.
In fact, funny enough, I mean, back in those days, particularly the 70s, we were doing tons and tons of jingle work, advertising music.
Yeah.
And yeah.
Did you enjoy
And
that process?
I did. I did. It got old after, I don't know, 10 years or something. But, it was very demanding because in order to be a successful studio cat, so to speak, you had to. A, be able to work well with everybody. B, you had to be able to play different styles because not all commercials were of one style. So, you might come in and do a day's worth of Coca-Cola commercials and it would be the same song, but you would be doing 60 seconds, 30 seconds, 15 seconds in pop contemporary style. And then you'd do a Latin style and then you would do an R&B style. So, to be able to do all these things was a certain set of skills that one had to acquire. And I just loved that challenge. And in fact, having to learn those styles really kind of increased my own vocabulary as a soloist and as a writer as well. So it was a real godsend. But what we used to talk, the joke was, well, yeah, I do commercials in the daytime so I can support my habit at night of playing,
Right.
being more inventive and creative.
You want a whopper? It's late at night. Come to Burger King and we'll treat your hunger right.
Past midnight, at Burger King, drive through, at Burger King. Miller's made the American way, born and brewed in the USA, just as proud as the people who are drinking it today. Miller's made the American.
Yeah, and then Jimmy Page, didn't Jimmy Page say something very complimentary?
Yeah, he gave me an 11. 11 out of 10. Jimmy's a cool guy. We actually first met back in 1967 when the Yardbirds were touring America. And I was a music teacher in Lima, Ohio, of all places. So they played that evening and we got to hang out, play a little music together, have a chat. And years later, he's resurfaced with this wonderful comment of his, and I respect him enormously. He's just a really superb musician.
Yeah.
Actually, going back further than that, in 67, when I came back to New York, I was fortunate enough to meet and befriend Jimi Hendrix.
You're kidding.
No. And he was just lovely. What a cool guy.
Yeah.
We used to get together and jam, usually at my parents' apartment. And I'll never forget the look on my mother's face when Jimmy came to the door the first time.
Really? Like, Jimi Hendrix came to your parents' house and jammed
yeah,
with you?
Yeah, absolutely.
Wow.
And aside from jamming, we'd spend hours listening to pretty much The Impressions, Curtis Mayfield. Curtis was like a huge influence in both of our styles. His guitar playing was so unique.
Really?
Yeah,
so
absolutely.
Curtis Mayfield was not only a major guitar influence on you, but also Jimi Hendrix, and you kind of, you were there to see that kind of, with your own eyes.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Do you remember which records you were playing with Jimmy of his?
Well,
I guess it would have been the earlier ones, right? Yeah,
well,
the
I mean,
Impressions ones.
When we jammed, it was mostly, Rocky Blues.
Mm-hmm.
But the stuff that we were listening to was on the first Impressions album, which was It's All Right. And let's see. Amen was another one. I have to look back on the album, but it's just filled with really with goodies. And the thing about Curtis Mayfield's style also was that the way he approached like double string parts and harmonies and stuff was so uniquely his. And it just sort of filtered out eventually into the world of pop recorded music. But he was big into, playing sixths down to fifths and all these little guitar tricks.
Yeah. Yeah. And he was just absolutely brilliant. I love Curtis. That's cool. That's really cool. Any other Jimmy stuff? Like, what was he like? What was he into? Just any memories?
Yeah, he was a very sensitive guy. He was very placid and peaceful. When you see the pictures of him burning his Stratocaster and stuff, I think that's not really Jimmy. That's just him being a show, but I do remember my last conversation with Jimmy, and this is an interesting lesson, if you will. It was back at the Isle of Wight Festival in 1971. And we were both backstage. I say stage, there were a bunch of tents set up behind the festival stage. And he looked really sad and forlorn. And I said, Jimmy, what's going on, man? And he said, well, he said, I don't know. I just don't know anymore. I don't know who my friends are. You know, I keep getting people hitting on me, and it's not because they like me, but it's other reasons. And I
So
just thought it was really.
he was struggling with the fame thing a little bit.
Yeah, it was really quite sad. And then it wasn't until a couple of months later, I was in Paris, and I heard the news that Jimmy had died. And I thought to myself, I understand this. You know, it was horrific. But he wasn't a happy camper at that point. Couldn't really deal with his fame and fortune. And part of that is because he didn't have enough real friends around him, I think. He had a lot of sycophants.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm sorry that you had to go through that.
Thanks. Thank you. But it was a life lesson. It was a real important life lesson.
So Reeland blows up. You know, that was huge. You know, for your career, it was also huge for Dumble and Walter because I feel like the success of that song kind of enabled them to. You know, kind of do more of whatever they wanted because they had already proven to have a success, right? So, for example, like Countdown to Ecstasy, their follow-up is it's a little bit more out there than Can't Buy a Thrill. And then
Yeah,
obviously when they're
I would have said adventurous, but out there works for me. Yes, it was. And they kept going further and further, you know, pushing the boundaries, as it were, not only in terms of the material that they were recording, but the way they were recording it. We had an engineer called Roger Nichols, who had just had, you know, the most amazing golden ears, and he understood how to mix sounds together so that you had a cohesive, listenable, enjoyable whole.
So did you keep tabs on Steely Dan, you know, post Reelin?
Oh, sure.
You
I
followed
mean,
them?
oh, yeah. The first 2 or 3 years when they would perform, and if we were in the same town, I would get up and perform with them. You know, we
Oh
played
yeah,
at
in
Mac.
72 and
Yeah.
73, you would play on
Oh
stage with them?
yeah, we did Max's Kansas City. I think we did Winterland. So that's coast to coast for you. But yeah, we've always, and still to this day, you know, when Donald's in town, I come and play with him.
Yeah, I saw you performed with Steely Dan as recently as 2019. Tell me about what those live shows were like because actually it's kind of it drives me nuts. There are zero recordings of any of their shows from 72 or 73 like out there in the ether. Like I haven't been able to find a single thing from those very
Yeah,
early years.
and I'm sure they're happy about that.
I know someone's got a hold of them, but they don't want that out there. I mean, 74, there's a whole bunch and it's great, but I would love to hear even those because the 73 band was like a totally different lineup and 72 also. So
Yes, sure.
I'm dying to hear that stuff. Do you remember what those shows were like, those early shows?
Oh, yeah, it was like, what's that great thing that the way they describe teenagers? It was like hormones in sneakers. Or hormones on steroids. We were just basically a bunch of guys, you know, trying to make the most of our stage time. And I don't think that we particularly bothered to find the most sophisticated level that we could be playing at. That didn't come until later.
Yeah, and that may be
It
part of the reason Donald doesn't want any of that, you know, out there.
that's right. That's right. In fact, funny story, at one point, one of the things right before the band stopped touring was Donald and Walter wanted the audience to be able to experience the sound of the band in a way that would be far superior to what you would hear in an auditorium with a PA system. So they worked at a deal with Sony to supply all the seats with headphones.
You're kidding. When was this?
No, this would be around 74-ish. I think Jeffrey Beccaro was in the band at that point. But you know, it never materialized. And
So, this is just
so,
an idea from Donald.
yeah. But they actually pursued it up to a certain point.
Wow.
And then when it proved impractical, that was it. That was the end.
Oh, wow. So his vision was for everyone in the audience to be sitting there watching the band, but to have headphones on instead of hearing it
He
through a
want yeah,
PA.
he wanted to share his own experience with the entire audience.
Wow. Interesting. And then after 74, they said no more touring. I think in large part because, I think it was like the wear and tear of the road he wasn't, too crazy about. But also I think just the audio didn't meet his like standard.
That's correct.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So is it true that Donald and Walter actually asked you to become a permanent band member at some point?
Several times.
Yeah.
The first time was during the making of Can't Buy a Thrill. And I declined for numerous reasons. One of them was I knew that they were looking to get rid of Jeffrey Baxter. And since Jeff and I had been tight friends at that point, I didn't want to see that happen.
Really? So actually they wanted to scrap Jeff on that first album, really?
And the other reason was that I had this gut feeling that the band wouldn't last beyond three albums with the personnel that they had. And sure enough, my gut told me the right thing, because when you get to Katie Lied, it's a whole nother set of personnel.
Yeah, that's when they kind of stopped being a band and they were just, it was Donald and Walter and whoever else they thought were right for the parts.
Yeah, I mean, Denny Diaz lasted
Yeah.
forever, and he's still, if there's a Steely Dan honorary club, he's one of the number one members.
For sure.
Brilliant musician.
But on those later albums, he's only on it a bit. Like I don't think he's on Gaucho at all, and he's only on Asia like on one song. So yeah, they really start to mix it up. Or they'd have, like Jeff Porcaro plays on basically all of Katie Lied, but then he's not on Royal Scammer Asia at all. It's, Chuck or Bernard Purdy.
That's right. That's right.
So yeah, they really shuffle things around. So Katie Lied, you did play on one song, right?
I did. I did. It's a tune called, if I'm, it serves me, it's Throw Back the Little Ones.
Yeah, it's a great song.
Thanks. It's another one of those really daft pieces of music. It's not like anything else that I've ever experienced.
Yeah, it's one of the more I find that song to be very Steely Dan, if that makes sense. It's very Donald, his
It's
vocal
yes,
delivery in the lyrics.
absolutely. And the
Yeah,
arrangement as well. The arrangement was very, very, the way Donald likes to arrange. In fact, it's really funny because that was possibly the most challenging of the solo sessions that I had to do with them. Because I came in and there was never any music written down for me. It was always just pick it up by ear. And I did, no problem. But this time there's this 4 or 5 page chart. Oh, what's this? And in addition to the various chord symbols, there were areas where they had already recorded the horns. And they'd written out a part for me to play with the horns as though I were part of the horn section. So I'd be going from solo, solo, solo to horn section, solo, solo, solo. And it was quite a demanding effort on my part. But I'm happy with the way it turned out. Purdy was my original drum teacher, actually.
You're
So,
kidding.
no. He and I have been friends forever and ever and ever. And
I love him so much. He's such a
me
great
too.
person.
Me too. And, Chuck as well. I mean,
Yeah.
Chuck and Paul Griffin. I mean, these are guys that I've known really since I started cutting my eye teeth in the studio.
Yeah.
And they've got a lot to do with my own development. So I felt like I was right at home.
Yeah, because it's on
Really.
Green Earrings, it's Chuck and Bernard, right?
That's right. Yep,
Yeah.
absolutely.
Phenomenal groove on that. I mean, just like that's just pure funk, you know. It's
Yeah, well,
it.
I mean, they just, they're as tight as a fist.
Yeah.
You know, they've got this pocket that nobody else
Oh,
has.
it's incredible. Yeah. But were you overdubbing on that one? Right, you
Yes.
weren't sitting in on the sessions, right, with Chuck and Bernard.
No, sadly, I actually never played any of the original rhythm tracks with the guys. I was
Yeah.
always brought in as a soloist.
Yeah.
But such is life, you know.
But you knew them elsewhere and you know, you played with, you know. What was tell me about your relationship with Bernard if you have anything else to share there. Just
We've done
any.
so many things together. He's come in and done sessions for me. I've done sessions for him. I remember once going out to NAMM when he had these little MIDI drum pads, which he asked me to demonstrate on guitar. So I pasted these little drum pads on my instrument, and he and I started sort of riffing together on the drums. It was great.
Any more specific memories about the green earring session when you came in to do the solo?
I remember bringing in my bag full of electronic goodies, and which consisted of, you know, various electroharmonics toys and musitronics toys. And I wound up at the end on green earrings. I used a Mutron biphase, which is that sort of bubbly sound that you get to hear. And I think I had it running through some sort of an overdrive or a fuzzy device before that. So it really, to me, was as much like a synthesizer as a guitar. One of my goals has always been to have the guitar be just like a synthesizer. And so if you find these various modeling objects that you can use post the guitar, you know, I was using something called a Fox tone machine at one point, and it was not just a fierce fuzz tone, but it was also a ring modulator. So if you hit one note and then a series of other notes, it would give you the sum and difference of the two notes that were being played. So you get this really unpredictable set of tones. And then running that through a biphase, the biphase is basically two phasers. It can also be used as one, as a stronger 180-degree phase, but it's very much like the components of a synthesizer. You know, you had a clock, you had different speeds that you could have your modulation running at, and it was in stereo as well, so it did an awesome figure eight.
So, you know, Steely Dan ends up kind of wrapping it up, you know, after Gaucho. Did you maintain a any kind of relationship with Donald or Walter, you know, through the 80s or 90s?
Yeah, every now and again we'd go and jam at the Lone Star, which, you know, he'd be doing his rock and soul review.
Oh, you jammed on some of those?
And that was the second time I said no. He was using Jimmy Vivino as his music. Donald was using Jimmy Vivino as his musical director, and Donald, at that point, after the show, said to me, "So we're thinking about putting together a new Steely Dan band. Are you into it?" And I said, "Let me give it some thought, you know." I said, "But I don't have your phone number at the moment." And he looked at me very wryly, and he said, "Get it from Jimmy Vivino." And I gave him a funny look, and that was the end of the conversation.
Why didn't he just give you his number?
Well, indeed. Good question. I think it was, mind games forever.
Yeah, fair enough. Did you tour with Boz Scaggs at all?
I didn't tour with him. We knew each other forever.
Yeah.
But the only appearance that I ever made with him was on Saturday Night Live. I got a call to come and, basically play with the band and with his band, which was great because he had Jeff Porcaro and I think Chris Parker also played. I think one or two of Jeff's brothers was on it as well.
Have you
I'm
seen
not sure if
that video?
of the Saturday Night Live thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, I've seen it too. It's you took a solo on Lowdown.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah, it's
And
great.
much to my horror, on watching it later, I thought, Jesus, I'm moving around too much. I think I'm upstate New Buzz. And it's one of those things where you sort of learn as you
Yeah.
go on. And after that, I kind of mellowed my movements down a bit. And sort of the focus should be on whoever the focus is on, not the guitar player, unless I'm doing a solo. Other than
Yeah,
that,
but it was a solo. It was kind of a Guitar Hero moment for sure. So I
yeah.
felt that what you did there, like, was it worked.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah. I saw some picture of like you and Walter in the 80s. Did you have like a friendship with him at all?
Yeah, I mean,
You kind of just knew all the guys, from the
I,
circle.
the thing with Donald and Walter is
Yeah.
that I valued them a lot.
Yeah.
And we didn't spend a lot of time at each other's houses and stuff, but just respected each other a whole lot. And so I think about it now, and there's an awful lot of people that, some of whom are gone, that I wish I had become closer with. But those days are gone forever.
Exactly.
So, what do? You shrug your shoulders, try and learn and move forward.
Yeah. I saw something about you and Laura Nyro. Like, not only did you work on her album, you went to school with her.
Yes. We were classmates at the High School of Music and Art. And we became fast friends. We had a singing group together,
In
me
high
and
school?
Laura. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Myself, Laura, and two other singers, two twin girls. And what we would do is during lunch hour, more often than not, music and art was right across the street from a park. And the park had some of these really cool tunnels where you can get some great reverb sounds. So we'd find our way to these tunnels and just sing for an hour before going back to class feeling really satisfied.
Wow. What was
And
she
I went up.
like? Because I'm really interested in her.
Oh,
It's a
God. She was a wonderful, wonderful woman
yeah.
all the way through. I mean, from even when we were kids, I just thought, this gal's terrific. And I wound up actually being asked to do her last album. I'm really glad that I did,
Yeah.
And at that point, my wife and I were kind of jokingly referred to her as Earth Mama. But she is. She was really, spiritual and down to earth and just plain lovely.
Yeah. In my interview with Rick Marotta, he also had like just great things to say about her. Said that he played on a session with her and she held up a picture of a chair. She said that she wanted him to play whatever he felt from looking at this picture of a chair. He
That
was
sounds
like,
like Laura. Yep.
yeah.
That's beautiful.
Yeah, she had this other kind of otherworldly quality to her. And also
Yes.
just an amazing singer and songwriter, in my opinion, one of the best.
Your opinion, I concur
Yeah.
100%.
And Donald and Walter have actually cited her as an influence in interviews.
Well,
I've seen them
she was,
mention her.
yeah, I mean, she was very inventive.
Yeah.
She could take three chords, which might be common chords, and turn it into something that you couldn't imagine. She just had that special knack.
Yeah. Yeah. So any of the other guys from kind of the Steely Dan circle that you were, any of them were you like closer to?
Jeffrey Porcaro. I mean, he and I became best mates. And he's missed to this day. He was such a nice man.
Yeah.
And I'm still friendly with Gary Katz. We chat on the phone every month or two. And I really miss Roger. I mean, it's just too bad that he wasn't able to keep with us.
Yeah, I interviewed his daughter for this show actually. So I heard about him through her, and yeah, just kind of everybody just has such like great things to say about him, both as in terms of as a person, but also, you know, obviously his work as an engineer as well.
I would be one of them. I mean, not just as an engineer, I mean, also as a visionary, because he, it's almost like saying he was the producer. He kind of heard and saw the finished product before it was finished. And he was a ray of sunshine. I mean, he had a repertoire of corny jokes that would make you tear your hair out. And it was always something new and unexpected. So yeah, Roger was number one in my book.
Yeah, very different than Donald and Walter, kind of these, you know, sarcastic, slightly misanthropic New Yorkers, and then you have Roger, who's kind of a
Absolutely. You got that right.
goofy California guy,
Right.
but just as brilliant, you know, in his own way. So I love that.
Yeah. And like Tommy Dowd before him, I mean, he was, a physicist, a scientist. I think he worked at JPL for a while.
Yeah, he studied like nuclear physics. I think he got a degree in it. So, are you in touch with Donald Fagen at all?
We haven't spoken in a couple of years.
Okay. Just curious.
Yeah, but I mean, if he comes over here again, I'm expecting to see him, give him a hug,
Yeah.
and maybe do a little playing.
Cool. Yeah. I've never made any contact with him. Yeah, which in a way it's good because I can just kind of, you know, keep a little distance. And you know, I'm more like, if it didn't go well, would that affect me, you know, doing the podcast or something, you know? So it's kind of nice to have that, you know.
I can understand that feeling. Although I think if you met Donald now, you would really appreciate him. He, I don't think he's got a lot of baggage. I think he's been through it, been there, done that, got the t-shirt, and he's cool.
Yeah. I mean, people just have, you know, mostly, you know, positive things to say about him. So
Yeah,
it's
I mean, my
been now.
last encounter with him, which was the show that we did at the O2 Center here, I just found him more down to earth than ever before.
So he's mellowed with age a bit, so to
Oh
speak.
yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, great.
I think we've all kind of, got rid of a lot of the hang-ups that we had as younger men. And so relationships can grow. And that's what one always hopes for anyway.
I spent a lot of money and I spent a lot of time. The trip we made to Hollywood is etched upon my mind. After all the things we've done and seen, you find another man. The things you think are useless, I can't understand. Are you reeling in the years? Sowing away.